Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios in Beijing. I'm your host, Kaiser Guo. Joining me today are Cynical stalwart Gotti Epstein, bureau chief of Forbes here in Beijing. How are you, Gotti?
Good, Kaiser, thanks.
And Bill Bishop, who I'm very glad to welcome back. It's been months, Bill.
How are Nice to be back.
To see you again. And the lovely Li Xin, managing editor of Caixin's English edition. She also joins us today. Great to have you back, Li Xin.
Thanks.
How was Brazil? You were in Brazil, huh?
Yes, Brazil was good. The lovely weather, but Beijing's weather is picking up as well. So yeah. Good.
Anyway, we will also be joined later in the show by John Garneau, fingers crossed for that, China correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. Before I introduce today's topics, just a quick celebratory note. We started this podcast a year ago this week. Our first podcast actually focused on Google, which had just then announced its sort of quasi-withdrawal from China. And that went up on April 2nd, 2010. I've had a great time doing this. You, Gotti?
Yeah, definitely. First year anniversary.
Thank you. And as we enter our second year, we've got...
Bill, too. Bill was on the first podcast.
Bill was on the first one, too. Yeah.
Sorry, I forgot to bring a cake for the first anniversary.
You know...
CC Suites in Central Park.
As we enter our second year, we've got a whole bunch of really good guests still lined up. Very interesting topics. China never fails to deliver up very good news topics. So spread the word about Cynica. We are always eager to hear your suggestions. You can write to us at our podcast page. So last week, John Garneau, who, as I said, will be joining us later, he published a really good piece in the Sydney Morning Herald about the massive ongoing fight between two Chongqing NPC delegates, a guy named Zhang Mingyu, a guy named Wen Zhenjie. Zhang Mingyu is a wealthy real estate developer. He very publicly and forcefully accused Wang, who is, among other things, the head of a large securities firm, of being essentially a corrupt, bribe-taking gangland boss. This is, of course, taking place against the backdrop of Chongqing Party Secretary Bo Xilai's ongoing attacks against organized crime. So we're going to look at Chongqing, Bo Xilai, and this remarkable battle. But before we get to that, we're going to talk about another couple of things. This being the one-year anniversary of Google's semi-pullout. I mean, I can't say that without thinking about sexual imagery, but semi-pullout from China.
Are we censoring this podcast?
We are. Okay. And they're moved to Hong Kong. Let's chat about a bit about what's happened since. And since we've got veteran internet watcher Bill here with us, let's start with him. What's happened? Where do you think things stand now, and does it really matter?
Since Google interrupt us?
Yeah, Google interrupt. Oh, Google interrupt us.
I think the short answer is it actually doesn't really matter. You know, the Chinese internet is even more vibrant and even more robust, and there are more users, and Google search is still accessible through the Hong Kong site, has actually not been blocked in spite of all the recent increase in restrictions. And you know, Google as a company itself, that they will tell you that their revenue is still strong. I think most of that comes from selling overseas ads to Chinese companies. Inside China, their market share is down to what? Mid-digit teens.
Right. Yeah, mid-digit right. teens.
Baidu and, you know, they've had a pretty...
Wait, let's clear that up. Baidu has 84%.
Right. Depends on who you're asking.
No, no. I mean, if you ask any, it's 84% by search traffic.
The definition of monopoly
Kaiser
is what,
60%? Kaiser will be in the hot seat on Baidu in a second.
I will be, that's right.
So from the market share perspective, clearly they've gone down significantly. I mean, it was over 30 when they pulled out or they announced they're pulled out. They've lost pretty significant amount of technical talent. You know, they've had a bunch of problems
also
with their resellers.
They've had internet revenue growth on the back of fundamental revenue growth in the Chinese internet market that's much faster, much higher.
But they have yet to disclose, is that revenue growth from the Chinese, you know, Chinese users in China, or is it from Chinese companies buying ads supposed to overseas? I've never seen them actually break
export,
out that money.
Export's always been about 50% of what they do, which is what accounts for that.
They've said it's a mix, and analysts estimate their growth rate at, you know, I think what 20% or something by comparison year on year, by comparison to a market that's growing much faster than that.
Right. So I don't think
it's lagged the market.
It's definitely lagged the market. I'm kind of guesstimating the growth rate, but it's absolutely lagged the market.
I mean, Lisa, do you think Chinese users really care at this point?
Well, not much. First of all, not too many people are using Google. So at that time when they put out, people are most upset about it is probably English reader or who are probably more international oriented, and then they can switch either to Google Hong Kong or many of this, including my well, including myself, I didn't use Google China at all. I used Google International. So that,
and that's you use it mainly for English language search anyway, right?
English and Chinese. English and Chinese as well. Sorry.
No, that's fine. I mean, I use Google all the time too.
But the other thing too is what's happened, I think, among that sort of high demographic, sort of people assume what's the Google user base would be upset, is that whole user, that whole demographic has been massively distracted by the rise of Sina Weibo.
That's right. I mean, I think that's probably the biggest internet story of 2010, right, mm-hmm. is the rise of Sina
Weibo. And that had nothing, it had nothing to do with Google being in China or not. It would have happened in Google. I mean, Google doesn't do Twitter or Weibo in the U.S., and so that would have happened regardless of where Google was.
And this gets you. This gets back to your main point of it doesn't really matter. Like, by the end of the year, people have sort of forgotten the Google story, except in a year in review sort of look back kind of way. The Sina Weibo had become the dominant internet story.
Yeah, I mean, the fact is, and it's hard, if, I mean, Americans, we always want to think our companies are the best. Google's irrelevant here. It's right. Kind of sad, but it's true.
Right.
Well, on that note, the dominant internet story of this week sort of put me in the hot seat, and I'll hop back into that hot seat and do something really kind of unusual for the Seneca podcast. I'm going to hand over the controls to Gadi and to the other two of you, to Lee Sin, a veteran journalist herself, and to Bill, who definitely tussled with a bit about this issue. As you know, probably if you've honestly been living in a cave, Baidu has had some problems with publishers and writers. I'm going to talk about that very candidly and try not to sound like a complete PR tool. Apologies ahead of time if I do end up sounding like a tool, but I'm getting very, very proficient at apologies.
You'd be doing your job.
Yes, yes, yes. So take it away, Gadi. You lead.
All right. Well, shall we make this a struggle session?
Yeah. I'm prepared to write a self-criticism.
Which is sort of appropriate when we're going to talk about Chongqing and Bo Xilai later. Obviously, what happened here is Baidu. So, for those who aren't familiar with this story, Baidu Wanku, their library service, has 2.8 million or had 2.8 million works in its literary works,
right?
Yeah, category. Many of which, I mean, it's unclear probably what the real number is. Were you know probably up there illegally, or you know maybe you know people were downloading them, and not you know this is all free service. They were uploaded without the permission of whatever license holders might have the rights to those works. And authors have been struggling with Baidu and publishers, especially.
Right. Beginning on March 15th, which is Consumer Day.
To clarify, unlike Google Books, they were actually uploaded by users, not by Baidu
correct.
Itself, as far as we know.
So basically Baidu was the platform for
right.
it. And it was sort of like I described it in my blog post as sort of a Napster for books. Except that the difference in this case is the Napster was started by, you know, a major company, Baidu. It was not just some sort of a guerrilla outfit.
Right.
So obviously the authors did not like this. The publishers did not like this. They've taken you on very publicly. There were talks last week that fell apart. The authors and publishers claimed that Baidu's attitude has been arrogant and unresponsive or not responsive enough. And Han, the very popular blogger and guy who was a best-selling writer before he was 20 years old, took you on most probably publicly and most effectively in two blog posts, one called Shame on Baidu and the other a letter to Robin Li, the billionaire CEO and co-founder of Baidu, who happens to be now the richest man in China, according to my magazine, Forbes. So we are – this week – Baidu's response in the days from Saturday to basically Tuesday was basically to take down 2.8 million works out of the literary works category and hopefully start fresh with the authors and the publishers.
Right. We threw a whole bunch of manpower and a lot of technology against this problem. Beginning on Saturday, we announced that 72 hours later, we would have cleared the thing out. We would have scrubbed everything more or less clean. And as of yesterday, around noontime, there were less than 1,000 items that were remaining in that particular section. Now, the number, when we began this whole endeavor, there were more than 18 million items total in Wanku. And right now, there are less than 16 or somewhere around 16 million. So a total of more than 20 million items have actually been.
Or 2 million. You're getting your English and your Chinese number
yes,
systems.
so two million from the site. And, of course, there's usually – in the course of any given day, there's quite a few that are.
And just to keep us updated on the news before we get into the struggle session, any news today from response from anybody in on the other side of this issue?
They've done some media, and they've said that they're encouraged by Baidu's response to this. And I think, but, you know, we hope that they recognize it for the good faith effort that it is.
Encouraged, but a wait-and-see attitude.
Right, still definitely wait-and-see. Yeah. They've pointed out, and I think correctly, that there still probably are a lot of pieces of infringing content on other sections of the site, and we're starting to chew through that as well.
Now, on the Baidu side, I mean, some of these authors actually are able to sell their works through Baidu and make money, right?
So, that's, for example, correct.
Doesn't Han Han actually make money selling his work through Baidu?
He does. I mean, we have on our open platform, our Box Computing open application platform, if you type in, for example, San Chong Men, the name of it's probably most famous and first big novel, you can actually buy it for 5 kuai, and Han Han and presumably his publishers get a share of that.
Right, and so, you haven't said how many he's actually sold.
No, we haven't. We haven't released that number.
All right, well, so the red meat's now in the center of the room. I'll throw out the first question, the first chance that we have to have Kaiser in the hot seat for in the whole year that we've done this podcast. I think the most obvious question that some people have is why, if you can do this, take these down and talk with the authors and go in that order, why didn't you do this earlier?
Well, simply, I mean, the answer is very, very simple and obvious, is that we just simply hadn't had this vocal of an outcry. We had always represented that we had a very transparent channel for complaint. There was a large link. The terms of service very clearly state that users are not to upload anything that they don't have proper copyright to.
But they were doing it, and you definitely had private complaints. Maybe you didn't have the public outcry.
Oh, no, we had plenty of you people using the complaint channel. And as I've said many times, we had taken down. I mean, it's visible there on the complaint channel. Everything that we actually take down, and there were tens and tens of thousands of infringing pieces that we had removed by people using that complaint channel. Now, I can completely sympathize with anyone who thinks that complaint channel was somehow inadequate because, well. Yes, it does require you to produce, evidence that you are,
right,
in fact, the legitimate copyright holder. So the first thing that we did last week, before we sat down to negotiate, was we said we are giving them a sort of green channel by which they can just approach us with the certificate and say, we are a publisher of the following titles, and that's it. If anything in that list appears, we take it down, no questions asked.
Still, the burden was on them, and you have basically these guys are sort of – many of them are small publishers or authors, and it's not like movie studios or music companies in the U.S. that are experienced with teams of lawyers to go to these sites in the U.S. and challenge them, send letters, get things down very quickly. That sort of infrastructure isn't here. And so, especially for authors,
right,
for writers.
There wasn't actually any need to go to those elaborate lengths. They didn't need teams of lawyers in order to do this. All they needed
time.
Right. Well,
it's very fast to upload
The bigger issue, too, is for certain issues that the government deems problematic, all the big internet companies have systems in place to be very proactive in filtering the content. This is an area where the government really hasn't actually put a lot of pressure on the companies to date. And so it's more like what you can get away with. It's what you saw with the video sites, right? Where you had the Tudos and the Yokus and all those guys were basically, if you send us a letter and it's infringing content, we'll take it down. But certainly if it's about us, if it's a video clip about something very sensitive, of course it never even goes up. And the answer was, oh, well, it's very hard. And, Safe Harbor, we can do it for you, but you got to prove it. As soon as Sarft came out and said, we care about video copyrights, take them down. Within like 2 days, all the pirate stuff was gone. Well, so it's more of a mentality as opposed to...
Yeah, what do you say?
I think it's
a very frequent complaint.
I think a lot of it represents is it's the way things are here, which is it's not what's right or wrong, it's what you can get away with.
Since I was at Yoku at the time that a lot of this stuff was happening, and I think as anyone will know, I'm able to tell you, I mean, my wife was constantly browbeating me about being responsible for having a lot of her favorite television shows removed. We had to work with MPAA, with other organizations. They had to provide us with some sort of a digital DNA, a piece of a fingerprint that we could work off of. Otherwise... how do we identify something as infringing?
Right, but when the software came down, did they have that infrastructure in place?
Because yes.
Everything just disappeared within like 2 days.
Well,
it was gone.
There were a couple of ways to go about it. I mean, you could either sort of
You can presumptively take stuff down.
Right,
and that's a different approach that you guys haven't taken it.
The thing that these companies have in common is that they are, at the end of the day, they are consumer-facing companies. They're user-facing companies, right. And they take very seriously, as we take very seriously, the interests of our users.
What about what the U.S. Trade Representative says about deep linking, for instance, to music?
Again, I think everyone in the industry is aware that we have been talking in great depth and for a great length with a lot of different labels, and that we have deals in place with many of the major Chinese labels, if not most. I wouldn't necessarily say it's numerically most, but representing a huge amount of the actual repertoire of at least music from the East Asia region, from the Greater China region. We are, I think, as everybody knows, we have always been in touch with the majors. And
let me explain this. So basically, if you search on Baidu, you search, let's say, the Beatles. Let's take the example of the Beatles, because someone was pointing something out about this to me recently. You can get all sorts of links to music that's unlike, you know, you basically get the music for free. What was pointed out to me is that if you had your VPN on and you are searching from outside of China on Baidu and you do the same search, you don't get those results.
But Youku at least, if not Tudo, do that. No, they just do IP region encoding. So basically, they don't want, you know, they don't want.
But so the region encoding.
The Hollywood studios, so they have the
stolen. I don't know the
point is you can steal the music within China.
Right. I don't know the actual inside.
They make it so you can't steal the music if you're
in
the
US. If it's an actual deal, like Kaiser has said, where you have deals with a lot of the Chinese record labels, like the Google Music product. Those deals are
correct,
actually
but that
only
deal,
valid.
There is no such
China.
Deal for the Beatles.
I can actually answer for that. I mean, I think that what's actually going on here is that they're realistic. They understand that there's a different price point at which somebody will actually pay for a song inside of China and outside. There's a whole bunch of different user expectations, and so I mean, this is sort of realism on the part of the record labels. I mean, they've probably
tolerating the fact that this is happening within China.
I think that everyone has sort of accepted that no matter what happens at the end of the day, they're going to be getting paid at some point, whether that's on some sort of an advertising revenue share basis or just flat minimum guarantee payments. They're going to get paid, but it's not going to come out of the users' pockets.
The thing that's interesting with Baidu's history is when Baidu went public, was it 2005?
That's
right?
Correct. Yeah.
In the SEC filing, one of the disclosures, I think the number was 23%.
It was 30% at that point.
It was a very significant percent of your traffic.
That's
came
gone
from
down to
searching, a big chunk of Baidu's early business was built on the back of illegal MP3 downloads. That was acknowledged by everybody when it went public.
You say illegal, of course. So.
Well, and that's still what USTR says, and they still call you notorious. You Baidu,
right?
Not Kaiser Guo.
Notorious K.
You might be notorious as well, but Baidu, notorious for piracy, and they cite the music issue in particular.
Sure, of course.
And it's I think what you've just said that they tolerate this is probably kind of wishful thinking.
Well. You know, I'm not at liberty to talk about any details about anything that may or may not be going on between us and certain recording industry.
But
I told you,
it's fair to Kaiser. I mean, Baidu is the largest internet company in China now. It's the third largest by market cap in the world. So you guys are a natural target. But you're not doing anything anything different from pretty much every other internet company in China.
That's right.
Taobao built this business on counterfeit goods.
But in fairness, it is public criticism that's spurred you to action. That's a fair point to make, right?
Yes, I think that's fair.
People who were making complaints through private channels got frustrated.
And unlike the musicians, you know, the writers, are, I think, are a much more articulate group who are much more sympathetic and have access to all the, you know, major media in China. And so they brought, I think, some extremely intense media pressure to bear both on the company as well as Robin Li personally.
I think Li Xin wants to say something.
I think Han Han made a point that Baidu picks up the easy target, that's the writers. They didn't make the movie, they didn't pick up the target with the movie industry, which probably is more financially stronger to.
My interpretation of that is different. My interpretation of that is different. There's a bandwidth issue in terms of having online video, pirated online videos. What they have is a site that's more of a Hulu-like model, which might be more financially viable.
Yeah, but I can see it from Han's point of view here. I can understand why he would point out this and think that it's hypocritical, that we're perfectly willing to pay full market price to license video content and put it on a site like Hulu.
Right.
On
exactly.
GE, right.
Right.
So yeah,
fair enough.
Let me just say here for the record that Baidu never intended to just stand here and thumb our nose at either the publishing industry or the recording industry. We honestly have tried to balance the interests of users and make sure that everyone in both of these value chains, but with the user still ultimately in mind, benefit from this. And I really think that if this whole episode has really shown us anything, it's that we are an incredibly powerful distribution channel. I mean, we have, yes, disrupted two very major industry value chains and disintermediated certain people. And we move fast. We want to find a way to work together. And we really think that, the future, in the future, we're going to be an indispensable part of both of those value chains. We do not want anyone excluded.
Okay, I know you want to be customer facing. There's another question that came up from a reader of my blog who seems to be very familiar with these issues. Apparently Baidu says it does not know or cannot determine who uploads this content, who uploads pirated content. Is that
Let's say we have IP addresses, of course, but whether are we going to actually to facilitate going after these people, if we were asked to by law enforcement, yes.
Okay.
Would we initiate actions against them on our own? No.
Okay.
In all likelihood, no.
Clear explanation.
What's sort of also back to my point earlier about it, sort of, Baidu is the target now, but everyone's doing it. A few months ago, Shanda, the big US listed company as well, has a very large literature division. And the head of Shanda Literature went after Baidu and tried to organize these writers to get together.
Right, they say that up to 80% of their libraries are.
Right,
there.
Criticized Baidu, and then all of a sudden he went silent. Why did he go silent? Because everyone pointed out that actually Shanda Literature has a whole bunch of pirated content too. Right? And so his legs were completely cut out from under him. And so, again, I think you go back to, yes, maybe we should expect or hope that you might see more of a proactive stance from some of these, world-class, world-beating internet companies. But until you have a situation where the regulatory environment is in place and the government cares about these issues, you have to expect that these companies are going to do what they can get away with. Now, the other point I want to make is in spite of all this hoopla, in spite of Han, in spite of all this stuff going on, investors don't care. Baidu's stock price went up.
No, in fact, they probably like it. But I absolutely care, and I agree with you on that. And actually, this is the point I made in my first post about this week, that this is China's problem, not just Baidu's problem. And that is, in fairness to Baidu, there should be a level playing field here, and the government needs to be involved and actually take enforcement seriously.
Li Xin, do you think that the IP environment is changing here, the government's attitude is changing?
It is changing, but I think it's mostly from the outside pressure because the U.S. government is pushing that in whatever opportunity they get. And also the some of the arguments we see on our website is they think Baidu is listed in the U.S. and Robin Li is educated in the U.S., so they should have known better.
And in other words, Baidu is – this is the flip side is Baidu is the leader in this field. They should be a role model, but you can't do that in a regulatory vacuum. I mean, you can do it, but you do need help. You need help from enforcement. Otherwise, other folks will do what Baidu has been doing and steal market share.
Made an important point, which I have a question about, because I saw the two writers who seem to have been the most vocal against Baidu were Han Han and this writer whose pen name is Mu Rongxue, right? Yeah. And Mu Rongxue, especially on Weibo, was quite nasty and specifically. Basically was trying to spread innuendo about Robin Li
still having
a green card at one point. I think he gave it up. But saying Robin Li had a green card, saying, all this stuff about how Robin Li spent so much time in America. And my sense of it wasn't he should know better. It was actually trying to incite people to say somehow Robin Li, again, this just shows he can't be trusted because he spent all his time in America.
Right, Han made
Ha Han made the point.
Gratuitous
that,
references.
Yeah, gratuitous. It was I was trying to understand what was American the point of those gratuitous references. Were they
says innocuous? The man who's about to take a New York Times column.
Yeah, were they innocuous like you're saying, or were they more like trying to get people to support them and basically saying, oh, look, see, this is a partially American company, so we should go beat them down.
It's a sop to nationalists.
Yeah. Well, it just depends on how you interpret it.
Right. How did you interpret it?
I interpret it as you should know better.
Okay.
It's like higher standard. If you coming from the level playing field, you should play that way.
I think it probably plays both ways.
I think you're not familiar with the way American internet companies operate either. I mean, this whole idea of safe harbor, it really originates in the United States.
True. It's something that eBay
But it's very different in China because of the way that so much content has to actually get filtered. So stuff that Chinese internet companies do in terms of dealing with government regulations would immediately destroy any concept of safe harbor in the U.S.
I don't think that this parallel is exactly – I mean I understand the urge to draw that analogy between internet censorship on the one hand and our ability to filter for potentially infringing content. The difference is that we, you know, with filtering for politically sensitive content, a word is good enough. A couple of, you know, of characters appearing are good enough to trip a signal. But how would we? What would trip something that tells us that a word file that happens not to be somebody's resume, but rather, or you know, a college essay they wrote?
The point is, if you have systems in place to screen content, then in the U.S. at least, and all content goes through the screen in the U.S., your DMCA protections go away. So the question here, I mean, I read some stuff. It sounded like there was not actual consensus among Chinese lawyers about whether or not Baidu was protected by the safe harbor.
There's not consensus, right. But the court so far ruled in favor.
Right. But
we're not, we don't want to sit there and use the law as a shield, as it were.
I think we should come close to wrapping this up. Okay. So, give us a prediction. The next step.
First of all, the bottom line is that Robin in Shenzhen at an internet summit just the other day said, if we can't work out something amicably, we're going to shut the service down. So that's,
not worth the headache for you guys.
That.
I mean, there's no revenue involved at this point.
Well, I mean, I'm
the minimus.
Happy to, right. Oh, that's the other point I really want, because right now this is not a revenue generator for
right.
us.
Right. It's a service that draws in users.
That's right.
And that clearly makes you money indirectly.
I mean, since 99% of internet users in China are already Baidu users,
I know Baidu is going to make money anyways. Right. But so this is probably not a material hit to you.
So what my prediction? I mean, it really depends on the reaction of the publishers. You know, I think we've been contrite. I think we've reacted with alacrity to these accusations, and we've taken stuff down. I think we're doing.
Do you think the attitude in the past was too arrogant and not controlled?
I wouldn't call it arrogant. I don't think it was arrogant.
Or not responsive enough. I think it dismissive.
Was perhaps just a little bit.
The complaints that were there.
Well, I mean, I think it was just confident that we were simply because we had the law on our side that what we were doing was fine. And I mean, I don't think that there's anything we could be morally impugned for this, but we certainly don't want to antagonize them either. Not just because they can be vicious, but just because we want to work together. We want to work together profitably on this.
And one last point is it's funny because before Google's pullout, they were getting pillared in the press by these Chinese writers.
These same writers.
It turns out that, of course, Google's deal was much better.
Right,
which they've specifically cited.
Right, it was, maybe we should have been better to Google because it actually was much better.
Well, on that note, I think this is good to end our first anniversary edition of Put Kaiser on the Hot Seat. Let's do it again
also
next year.
The Baidu Struggle Session.
Baidu Struggle Session. We'll do it again in a year from now.
Our next topic, we are joined by John Garneau, who is the correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age here in Beijing. And he's just joined us at the podcast studio. Gotti, unfortunately, and Bill both had earlier engagements and they had to take off. So we're joined now with John, and we've still got Li Xin with us. And we're on to our next topic, which is the Battle Royale in Chongqing. In January of this year, at a meeting of the Chongqing NPC delegation, Zhang Mingyu got up and presented a 5,000-character indictment of Wang Zhengjie, accusing him of bribe-taking and of gangsterism, essentially. He called him a malignant tumor, and he touched off a massive firestorm. Yes, that, to my knowledge. John here has thus far been the only person to really report on in English in any depth. John, you've written a fascinating piece on this. And Li Xin, you grew up in Chongqing, so we're going to let you guys take the stage here and talk to this a bit. I'd actually ask our regular guest, Jeremy Goldhorn, why he thought no other English language publications had talked about this, what I thought was a really great story, and why it got so little coverage. He suggested that Western news anchors just couldn't pronounce Chongqing. I'm sure that many of our listeners do know a thing or two about the place where Li Xin grew up. You tell us a little bit about the city that you grew up in, about Chongqing, and why it's so important these days in China.
Usually, I describe Chongqing to other people like the combination of San Francisco or Hong Kong and Singapore in a nice way, and the foggy London. It's very hilly. It's where the Yangtze River meets the Jialin River, And Chongqing people take a lot of pride of being the war capital of China during the Japanese invasion of
Right. My father was actually there. My father grew up in Shapingba during the war.
Right.
Right. So.
But for a very long time, Chongqing is sort of like forgotten down there, being located in the southwest, in the middle of the hills, and the transportation wasn't too good, and it took probably 2 hours and 2 hours and 50 minutes to fly to Beijing and this and that. And Chongqing was a very heavy industry city, and many of its major companies were state-owned manufacturers of weapons or weapon-related heavy goods. And then all of a sudden, when during the late 90s, when we have the switch from the state-owned industry to the market-oriented economy, Chongqing had a lot of laid-off workers and the troubled state-owned companies trying to turn around but failed. So that's why the city has a lot of safety problem as well as economic problem. And that's probably set a little background of what John is going to introduce, the wonderful story and terrific reporting.
Yeah. So, John, this story gets very complicated. So before we hop in, let's do a little bit of a sort of dramatis personae first. And let's look at some of the individuals who are involved. Wang Zhengjie, Zhang Mingyu, at Bo Xilai himself, Ye Xuanying. In your reporting, you talk about all four of these characters. And can you explain how they're interrelated and what went down and why this is so...
All right. Well, I think, The governing duo is Bo Xilai, right? And everybody should know Bo Xilai because he's the most handsome man in the Politburo.
I won't doubt that, yeah.
By the way, he has a major in journalism.
He does, and he knows how to treat journalism. You know, some have been exiled, some have never been seen, but he knows how to deal with journalists.
By which you mean not respond to their faxed questions, right?
No, I mean like they've been exiled and never come back, or worse. The mayor is Huang Qifan. He's like the opposite. Whereas Bo Xilai, you know, he doesn't care about the detail. He doesn't read the notes. He's just all charisma, movie star, son of one of the eight immortals of the Communist Party.
Boy,
that's right. One of the ultimate princelings. And walks like he owns the earth, which he kind of does. His mayor, Huang Qifan, is kind of the opposite. He's pockmarked, he's aged, he looks like he's kind of. Eaten too much kind of plutonium or something like that. and he's a technocrat. So he built Pudong in Shanghai. So if you've been to Shanghai, the fabulous kind of new area across the river, you know, that's his responsibility. It made his name. And so these two came together in Chongqing. One, Mr. Politics, Mr. Charisma, Mr. Pedigree, and the other kind of getting things done. And so they're the combination. Now, So Bo Xilai only arrived in 2007, and Huang Qifan, the mayor, arrived a few years earlier.
But he was a deputy mayor when he was firstly elected.
That's right. So he arrived as deputy mayor, but he's still involved in his responsibility was economic policy, right?
That's right.
Now, the businessman of Chongqing I talked to said that basically the problem was that when Huang Qifan arrived and he wanted to kind of, you know, create Shanghai and Chongqing, he found that it wasn't his city. He couldn't get things done. Everywhere he went, he was being undermined. And at the top of this kind of rebellious kind of local hierarchy was a guy called Wang Zhengjie. Now, Wang is a kind of, you know, he's a gangland man, but he's also got this very interesting weapons manufacturing industry background where he links up with the most important princeling in China today, who you mentioned,
right?
Ye Xuanying. So this guy Wang, you know,
it's the carrier group you're talking about.
The carrier group, exactly. So he arrives. So Wang arrives, build up. You know, he creates kind of, you know, he embeds himself in the financial infrastructure of Chongqing. This deputy mayor Huang Qifan can't get around him, so he's got to cut a deal. And so basically they divided up the city between them, and he was given these really weird, opaque, and, you know, I'd love to learn more in Caixin about how these things work, shareholdings in state-owned financial corporations, which people in Chongqing say he actually controls.
Securities firms.
Securities firm and also real estate. A trust firm and all sorts of, you know, yeah, that's right, they're the two main ones. So they're the characters. So you've got Bo Xilai, Huang Qifan, the party secretary and the mayor. You've got the super well-connected mafia boss, Wang Zhengjie, and you've got them trying to come to an agreement as Bo Xilai, and you might sort of introduce this later, Bo Xilai starts his kind of, he wants to make his name in Chongqing, and he's got to work out who do I need to bring on board and who do I dispose of.
Right. And so he launches what I don't know if it was originally called this, but Changhong Dahe.
He started with Dahe and then followed by Changhong.
Right. So Dahe means, you know, a strike black, which means attacking underworld criminal organizations. And that's probably, you know, what he's most famous for in his tenure so far in Chongqing, is that he's gone very, very actively against the underworld. How's that gone for him?
It's fairly well. I mean, the last time I was back was during the Spring Festival, and mm-hmm. all I heard from people was like the safety issue was really much, much improved, the safety situation from what before. And police would become very visible in the street, and sometimes a little bit overdone because they have these fancy police cars and motorcycles and the police booth, and it's almost like a merry-go-round for me, like the police booth at the street corner. But
now, so was it Zhang's idea that he would have some sort of political protection from Bo in going after Wang, because, I mean, by labeling him an underworld mafia figure?
Zhang Mingyu. Well, so this construction kind of started as a small-time motorcycle vendor, worked his way up, and like any kind of self-respecting businessman, became a developer. So Zhang Mingyu ended up building a pretty substantial property empire, development empire in Chongqing.
A couple of billion yuan, right?
Well, it's now worth, the assets in question are now worth, people say, about 2 billion yuan. Mm-hmm. So this is not small. Now, I, to this day, am not entirely sure what streak of madness prompted Zhang Mingyu to confront the mayor, Huang Qifan, and say, you've got to lock up the true mafia boss, Wang Jianjie, at the People's Congress in January. I will say that he's got his own connections, as every businessman person does. Mm-hmm. I won't go into them, but they're kind of, you know, they're not top tier. You know, he's not in bed with Bo Xilai, but, you know, they're substantial figures, because every business person has to kind of make sure they get along. But he took a huge punt. For him, it was, well, I've got two choices. I can just roll over and accept that I've lost everything that I've built up in the last 10 years, or I can take a punt and fight it. So he's taken a punt and he's fought it. He'd already lodged his complaint with the police last year, with the discipline inspection guys last year. Of course, nothing happened. And so this was his last roll of the die. And we've got to say, we don't know.
Oh, he went out in grand style with this one.
He sure did.
So what's happened in a couple of months since? I mean, did this blow up at the actual NBC in Beijing, and they're both delegates?
So, look, we spoke to Zhang Mingyu maybe a couple of days ago, and he's, well, first of all, he's still alive. That's
Which
good.
Is, yeah, miraculous.
No, it is. It doesn't always happen this way. He's still alive. He was in Guangzhou when I talked to him, but his family's still in Chongqing. They've got, you know, they've obviously got leverage over him if they chose to use it. Now, my reading is that maybe they haven't quite worked out what to do yet. I noticed that one of the big standing committee guys from the Politburo, He Guochang, who's involved in discipline inspection, he went down to Chongqing maybe last week, and he got something like 20 minutes on the Chongqing satellite TV news. You know, they want to have...
Without commercial?
Sorry?
The one without commercials?
Without commercials. 20 minutes straight of, you know, a standing committee member doing, you know, standing with Bo Xilai. You know, I don't yet know how this is going to be resolved. Usually in China, you can't have two winners. Someone's got to win and somebody's got to lose.
Right.
At the moment, both the mayor, Huang Qifan, and the mafia king, Wang Jianjie, and this property guy who got screwed over, Zhang Mingyu, you know, they're both still alive. All three of them are still alive. They're all in the game. But I'm not sure that it's going to stay that way, but I don't know how it's going to end.
So as I understand, you weren't able to speak to Bo Xilai or get responses from his office about this, but have you been able to infer anything from any public comments that he's made, what his stance is on this issue?
Bo Xilai, I haven't seen any word from Bo Xilai himself about this issue. Huang Qifan is different. This is the mayor. I did ask him about this when I crashed a press conference he gave about some property tax
right.
a little while ago in Chongqing.
And he sort of... paused and waved and
he smiled. No, he definitely heard the question and he turned it over. You know, maybe nobody's ever asked him that question before.
Right.
Because I must say that there were 200 Chongqing journalists in the room and they were all very polite to him. So he stopped, he turned the question over in his mind and he waved his arm at me and he kept on walking. So now, I'm not sure if that means that he, yes or no, or I don't really want to talk about this, John. But he didn't give me an answer. But if you go back through some of his public comments, he's been very supportive of this mafia king, Wen Jianjie. Mm. And he's, for example, he's said in public that he thinks this securities firm that he owns will become his huge company. I think he might have said it's something that's going to be worth 100 billion yuan. So he's publicly thrown his lot with this guy who doubles as the mafia king of Chongqing, which kind of creates a rather uncomfortable situation for him now.
And Zhang Mingyu has publicly said that, you know, he will take full legal accountability for this, that he stands by every character in the 5,000 character indictment that he handed down, and says that he's got him cold on all this stuff. You started your report with all sorts of great color about poker games where he was losing his shirt to, sort of deliberately throwing hands and, you know, paying up. Is this how it works? Is this how, you sort of lose money in gambling to somebody and rather than just sort of paying an outright bribe? Or
this Chongqing trip, I've got to say, it was one of my most enjoyable ever, because here was a guy, Zhang Mingyu, who was, in order to convince me and the public that the mafia king had taken bribes, he had to convince me that he'd actually paid
them. He's crooked, right.
That's right.
So, he's very forthcoming about this, not just to you, but I've seen...
That's right. And so, you know, it's wonderful. So the mafia king, Wang Zhenjie, has got this villa out in a prestigious part of Chongqing, very large villa. Everywhere he goes, he's surrounded by very attractive young ladies, and he's, one of his favourite games is poker. And at poker, you know, usually with... And he's kind of, his cronies tend to have either crew cuts or shaved hair and wear a lot of black. And they all sit around playing poker, one attractive lady to each person, losing tens and sometimes hundreds and sometimes millions of yuan at one hand. And so you've got all these fawning kind of wannabe businessmen, you know, falling over themselves to lose their hand at pokers. Oh, no, I lost another million to you, Wang Zhenjie. And funnily enough, Wang Zhenjie, the mafia king, never really loses. And so that's one of the ways which you kind of accumulate guanxi with this guy.
I see.
And it's not uncommon. It's not, well, Chongqing and Chengdu, Sichuan people in general, are poker players and mahjong players, but I don't think it's exclusive only to this region.
Well, that's one of the great questions. You know, lots of people would like to think, well, yeah, that's Chongqing. It was, you know, it was always mafia and it's different. You know, that's, I'm not sure.
So give us some background about Bo Xilai's Singing Red business, this Chang Hong. We were talking before the podcast, Li Xin, and you were saying how he was actually Zao Fan Pai, which means he was part of the sort of the really kind of hardcore Red Guard style faction during the Cultural Revolution. Even though his parents both suffered really badly during the Cultural Revolution, in fact, his mother was either done in or committed suicide. What's his relationship now because of this with the rest of the princelings?
Well, for that, all I have is hearsay, but the effect of the Chang Hong, I think it really surprised me during my trip back home in Chongqing. It's like people really embrace that wholeheartedly.
Embrace the idea wholeheartedly.
I mean, my suspicion before going back home was people probably would spend some time doing that because they were forced to, they have to, and that's part of the work. Usually, this kind of singing will be taking place during work hour. You train and you have choir, stuff like that. But this time, there was a holiday season. I was walking the street and I heard people singing national anthem. And we had this family gathering in my place. We had also my nephews and their kids, 6-year-old, get up and singing.
What are they singing? Like, you know,
Mao Zedong is. The Chairman Mao is the reddest sun in our heart.
Oh, my gosh.
And that was beyond my wildest imagination. It's like a 6-year-old who doesn't even know what a chairman is.
I've seen the same thing spontaneously. I must say, it's one of and some of these guys really can sing. I've sort of trained to Xinjiang when suddenly these cotton pickers were... they started thinking about all the babies they'd left at home for the cotton picking season. They all started crying, and the team leader said, "Somebody sing a song." And they started singing these fabulous Mao songs, you know, for hours. You know?
What is going on here? I mean, what's the thinking behind this? I mean, is this just sort of building up his nationalist credentials, or?
For him, that's part of his campaign. So what he has launched in Chongqing, I mean, Jump definitely didn't know that. It's a very comprehensive plan. So on one hand, he has this ideology, what we call ideology front. You have the Changhong, you have the Dahe, you touch on public security, you touch on the ideas and values, although those ideas and values are a little bit dated, but people still embrace that because they think it's better than nothing. What was replacing is a void, especially for parents. They think that works better than commercialism.
Right.
And on the other end, you have Huang Qifan helping Bo Xilai launching the urbanization experiment. Mm-hmm. They're trying to find a solution of farmers losing land, or whether how to get farmers the city credentials out and let them become part of the urban dwellers. So they have what they call the largest plan of cheap renting housing building in Chongqing, under construction in Chongqing. Wow. And they have this land for land for hukou. Is you farmers can trade the land use right for the residence permit in Chongqing, and all the benefits coming with all the urban benefits that is much, much higher and much more comprehensive than what you receive if you are a farmer. So that's on the economic front. And on the business front, they were really building Chongqing as the industry hub. They invite Foxconn meet this huge problem in Guangdong and Shenzhen with the suicides, and they invited Foxconn to build its largest plant in Chongqing.
Oh, I thought they were building in Henan also.
They're moving all inland, but in Chongqing, that was huge. And bringing with them a lot of chip makers or electronic manufacturers from Taiwan as well. Wow. So Changhong Dahe was part of that. That was probably the most visible part. Actually, the most visible part is tree planting.
Right. That's another one of those things. Yeah. That's pretty visible there, too.
Bo Xilai likes the Yingxing jingle tree.
He likes colors. So green, red, black.
Right.
Exactly.
He's a colorful guy. What can you say? Mm-hmm. I really look forward to more reporting from Chongqing from both of you. I mean, this is just fascinating stuff. And John, why do you think that you're the only person to have written about this in the English language?
Oh, look.
Is it just too inside baseball? It's just, you know,
well, whatever you're interested in, it's just a great story, right? It's a great gangster story. It's a great kind of ideology story. It's just a drama.
Well, let me put you in touch with somebody from Hollywood for the movie rights. You've got a really good
and
one going.
Let me add another plot to the story. I remember our reporters were covering Zhang Mingyu's real estate company in the year 2008. Mm-hmm. When the real estate price went down, he was still sitting on top of his wealth. Mm. And he actually sent messages to threaten our reporters.
Oh, look, this is very interesting because now Zhang Mingyu, to his great credit, has never claimed to be an angel.
Right.
Now, he's told me how he's bribed all these people, but basically, you know, his complaint is, well, surely in China you should at least get what you pay for.
That's funny.
That's funny.
So he never claimed to be an angel. I'd love to go back and see those old reports. Mm-hmm. But one of the Zhang Mingyu is, you know, if he's a hero, he's a very flawed one. But unfortunately, he's not the only person who's kind of come in for this sort of treatment. And one of the really sad things that I saw in Chongqing was genuinely honest, self-made, small-time entrepreneurs just being smashed. And they hadn't bribed their way to the top. You know, they started with restaurants and, you know, if they got lucky, they might have had a small little kind of real estate construction business, and exactly the same deal where, they didn't realise, but Wang Jianjie would kind of turn off the credit taps to them, so they're forced to go to the underground market, and as soon as they went to there, they were gone. So unfortunately, this is not just crooked, bold businessmen like Zhang Mingyu, but all sorts of people in Chongqing have been kind of struggling with this.
Well, I want to thank you both for coming, and thanks a little belatedly to Gadi and Bill, who were here earlier, and we will see you next week on the Seneca Podcast. We're out of time. We'll see you next week. Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, guys, thanks.
This is a news update from Taisin. US Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner has told a G20 seminar in Nanjing that controlled exchange rate regimes are the main problem facing the international monetary system. Geithner said that countries should have flexible exchange rates and allow free flows of capital if they want to play an important role in the global currency system. The conference in Nanjing is being attended by the French President Nicolas Sarkozy, as well as the heads of Europe and China's central banks. The meeting was organized by the French government, which currently holds the chairmanship of the G20. President Sarkozy presented an ambitious plan for reforms which would diversify the global financial system away from reliance on the US dollar. But the Chinese government has distanced itself from France's proposals, emphasizing that China is simply the venue for the seminar. Chinese commentators reacted more warmly to proposals that emerging currencies, including China's yuan, should be able to enter the IMF's special drawing right because of their growing role in the world economy. People's Bank of China advisor Li Daokui has said that the special drawing right system without the yuan would be ridiculous and lack legitimacy. 40 cities across China have set housing price control targets for this year. Beijing has announced the most ambitious target, pledging to keep property prices equal to or below last year's levels. The Shanghai municipal government said that it will keep the housing price growth rate below the economic growth rate and the per capita income growth rate. Taisin English Desk reporter Han Wei comments.
The Shanghai government still hasn't made clear exactly how the price cap will be set between purchasing power and GDP growth. And if we adjust for inflation, we can see that the growth in purchasing power is actually much lower than the GDP growth.
Shares in Chinese internet firm Qihoo 360 Technology more than doubled in price after their trading debut on the New York Stock Exchange this week. Qihoo 360 is one of China's biggest providers of internet security and browsing software. Qihoo is just the latest in a series of Chinese internet companies to see large stock price increases after listing on the New York Stock Exchange. Other recent examples include video website Youku and online retailer Dangdang. Since its IPO in December, Youku has since risen by another 34%, while Dangdang's stocks fell slightly, but are currently trading at 39% above the IPO price. China will impose a tax on rare earth minerals starting April 1st, according to a statement issued by the Ministry of Finance and the Ministry of Taxation. According to the new proposal, light rare earths, which are found mostly in southern China, will be taxed at twice the rates of heavy rare earths, which are mostly mined in Inner Mongolia. Taisin reporter Yu Hairong comments.
The price for a lot of rare earths are over 10,000, some as high as 20,000 yuan per ton. So the level of this tax is actually very low.
Profits for Chinese banks rose at the fastest rate in 3 years last year, according to China's Banking Regulatory Commission. The combined net income of Chinese banks increased by 35% in 2010, and China's five largest lenders increased their profits by 29%. The Industrial and Commercial Bank of China, which is China's largest bank by assets, reported a 28% rise in its net profits this Wednesday. Taisin English Desk's Song Huixia comments.
These profits show that the banking sector has a lot of strength and will reduce concerns about stability of banks and the number of non-performing loans.
Finally, the Shanghai Composite Index fell 1% at the lunch trading break on Thursday. Hong Kong stocks rallied following high earnings reports from a number of corporations, including Chinese banks. The Hang Seng Index rose 0.5% at the trading break on Thursday morning. You've been listening to a news update from Taisin. I'm Tom Hancock. For more information and the latest news on Chinese economics, finance and law, visit our website at english.caing.com.